versus American General Insurance, Mr. McGuane.
May it please the court, I'm Gary McGuane. I'm the attorney for the appellant and plaintiff in this cause, Carolyn Smith. There are three primary issues raised on this appeal. They are the trial court's ruling granting the defendant partial summary judgment on counts 1 and 2 on the grounds that there was no reliance by the plaintiff on the computer.
How old was Isaac when he died?
I believe he was 22, Your Honor. I'm not sure exactly.
Well, what did he die of?
He died of sickle cell anemia and complications there.
Of what?
Before you get any further, Mr. McGuane, I just wanted to clarify a point about jurisdictional amount, which is discussed very briefly in a footnote in Judge Holderman's brief. But it looks to me like the actual damages are $2,536 and some, the $2,500 from the contingency fee and then the excess premium payments. And so the only way you can reach $75,000 is with this $1 million request on punitives. Is that correct?
Yes, Judge. That or without specifying $1 million in particular, punitive damages is the only way to get above the jurisdiction.
Right. And we know on your vexatious delay claim, there's a cap under Illinois law of $25,000 in punitives. So you can't get enough in punitives on that. And I'm concerned about jurisdictional amount because the discrepancy is so huge between the actual damages in this case and the punitives. And I would like to call your attention to a decision of this court from a couple years ago called Del Vecchio against Conseco. It's at 230 F3rd 974. Which is a similar situation where actual damages requested are quite low, even lower there, $600, and they were trying to make up the jurisdictional amount on punitives, and we said in those circumstances it couldn't be done. So I realized that this hadn't come up before, but I wonder if you could, would it be okay if they gave us supplemental statements on that point? If you and your opponent could file a brief memorandum addressing the issue of jurisdictional amount and how the punitive damages might or might not be enough to meet it, I would appreciate it.
Well, I will do so, Your Honor.
Okay,
I will.
Within 10 days.
Within 10 days, yes, Your Honor. I will note that this case was removed, that I did file it in state court.
I'm not blaming you.
I'm going to be arguing against I'm arguing for a whole new trial for my client, Your Honor, but I will do so.
That's very good.
In any event, on the issue of the computerized receipt, there are just a few facts I'd like to lay out. I'm sure the court is familiar with the facts. But the plaintiff began paying $9.85 a month in March of 91. She paid that amount until December of 1995. The second policy that was issued by American General that they claimed as a defense in this case was issued in August of 1994, which was 16 months before she... I'm sorry, 16 months after that, she continued paying the $9.95.
Could you explain, what I find puzzling here, what is it you think that these agents were trying to do? I don't understand the scheme.
Well, originally, Your Honor, I don't believe there was a scheme. I believe there was an error. As the record indicates...
You mean an error in saying that her policy had lapsed or had her policy lapsed?
Her policy
the
had not...
The $15,000.
There are both. The first error was when she told the agent that she no longer wanted to carry a policy on a different child. She had three policies originally.
Right.
She told the agent, I no longer want coverage on this policy. From that date forward, there's no reason indicated in the record why, they stopped credit and spending payments to American General on two of the other children, including Isaac. No one knows why. There's nothing in the record to that effect. There is no question that they continue collecting payments. There's no question they continue giving a credit for payments on the Isaac policy. So,
that's the first.
The second one is when, at some point, someone realized this. We don't know who, because there's no evidence of that yet. And I don't think anyone's going to come forward and admit it.
Not someone in America, but one of these agents?
One of the agents submitted another policy.
The agents aren't employees, are they?
They are producers.
Contractors or something?
They are contract agents, producers. They only sell and collect for American General.
Okay, so you're saying they discovered the policy had mistakenly been deemed to lapse?
The only inference I can see is that they then purchased another policy to try to cover that mistake without telling my client. In or about August of 94,
That was the forged
application. They then had a new policy, increased premium, but with half the benefit. Didn't tell my client that. Continued from that date forward, filling out those hand receipts. Every receipt that was filled out after that had to be with knowledge that the policy had, in fact, lapsed.
Is there any evidence that prior to Isaac's death, she had knowledge of the reduced the reduced value of the policy?
No, Your Honor, to the contrary, when she filed her claim through the funeral home, that is when she first learned that there was a new policy and a reduced benefit both.
Right. So she knows something's fishy because she notices the policy number has changed and she notices that her premiums have changed. But I thought you argued that there was some language in the first policy that seemed to indicate premium payments might be adjusted.
That's right. She did not notice the difference in policy numbers.
No one ever told her.
No one told her and she did not check. And there's nothing in the record that indicates she did.
Okay.
In the complaint, I indicate that the new receipts showed a new policy number, and I reflect that fact in various briefs, but she never noticed
that.
She also didn't say that, she never said that, no, this is the wrong amount of premium. She asked that the day she got that first computerized receipt, why am I paying more money for the same policy? Which indicates she didn't think there was a new policy, and she didn't know why. She did not review the policy. I included that in the brief only to show that the trial court was incorrect in saying she should have known, if she's charged with knowledge of the policy, that they couldn't increase her premium. They could, in fact, increase her premium under certain circumstances at certain times. So even if she had read the policy, she would not necessarily have known that the increase was incorrect.
Now, but I don't know. I don't remember whether you argued this, but you assuming we don't impute the fraud of these agents to the company. Didn't the company act with alacrity when she complained?
No, Your Honor. There are on two occasions, a year apart, that the company was notified that she claimed there was another policy. When she first filed the claim, she made that claim notice, both through the claim she filed and when she had an attorney send them a letter saying, look, there's another policy out there.
But didn't they respond to that first letter? Are you talking about the February 1998 letter?
Yes, Judge.
I thought they responded saying, we don't show that there's a problem, but if you have some information, let us know. And then it was actually her side of the table, I won't say she personally because she'd hired this lawyer, but it was her side that dropped the ball for a whole year.
Well, Your Honor, the record only reflects the correspondence that we
right,
presented.
And in the letter from American General, they said, let us know if you have evidence to the contrary.
We did not include in the record other contacts between that time that were telephonic. That was
well. If it's not in the record, what's
I understand, Judge. But the defendant
so
keeps arguing that there were no
year as a blank. Then when it was revived a year later, didn't the company act very quickly to give her the full policy?
No, Your Honor.
The extra $7,500.
No, as soon as they were sent the receipts, they still said we're not going to pay until we have additional information. As soon as they before they got those receipts. When they got the first claim a year earlier from the other attorney, the letter and the claim they'd received, they got a death certificate that showed the name of the insured or the insured and his Social Security number. If they had, in fact, reviewed that policy upon her first complaint and looked at the application on the first policy, they'd have seen that they had a policy issued to an Isaac T. Smith with a totally different Social Security number. Why then did they pay the benefits on that policy to the plaintiff? They couldn't have done the review they claimed to have done, even initially in this case, because on its face of it, that policy appears to be for a different person. So our claim is they had knowledge both at the very beginning on the first complaint, and certainly by the time they got the second letter from myself, they knew at that point when they got the receipt that their agents had received these funds from the plaintiff all along through the life of the first bond.
What was the length of time when they you gave them the receipts until they made the payment?
I'm sorry, when I received I believe I sent them the receipt in either January or early February, and they paid late March. So it was approximately 60 days, I believe.
Well, you're not complaining about that, are you?
In part, Your Honor, because, again, they only paid because we could find an example of his signature. The policy of that company is that they don't pay, they keep asking for more information until the insured finally runs out of patience or can't find what they're asking for.
Well, that's not this case.
Well, it wasn't until I was able to find a copy of the young man's signature, Your Honor. They were not going to pay the claim until I got his signature, despite the receipts. Their response to the receipts was not, oops, our agents have done it again. They defrauded this person. They collected the premium clearly. There's no question about it. We'll pay the claim. Their response was, well, you need to send us a copy of the signature.
You said there were, and I think I recall, 31 boxes of complaints regarding this type of thing?
Yes, sir.
Was it this? I mean, they contest that. I thought they said, well, sure, we gave you all of our complaints, but they were all of our complaints, not just complaints focused on this kind of practice.
Your Honor, they were responsive to the interrogatory. The interrogatory, the document requests were directed to this particular type of claim. I reviewed them. Not all of them in those boxes were, in fact, directly responsive, but they all involved claims of fraud against the agent. They were based on this handwritten receipt book system that American General had put in place. A lot of them were, in fact, similar to this, but, again, that's not in the record. In any event, that was the point of that discovery, and there were boxes produced. I think I cited to the wrong part of the record in the initial brief. I think I cleared that up in the reply brief. So there's no question that there were thousands and thousands of similar claims. That, again, will go to the jurisdictional issue on punitive damages when we file that brief.
Well, maybe, except it's not a class action right now. Mm-hmm. Del Vecchio talks about that.
Go back to that February 1998 letter. American General's response was that their records showed that the $15,000 policy had lapsed. And then they ask her for, you know, any further information. That's when the year hiatus begins. But what was wrong with that response?
What's wrong with that response?
Their records showed it had lapsed.
Well, Your Honor, they are charged for other than punitive damages, which is the last issue on the appeal. They are charged with the knowledge of their agents. Their agents were collecting those premiums. They sent their agents to the plaintiff's house. They set up a system of the handwritten and computerized receipts. They put my client in a position where she couldn't prove that she'd pay those claims. These are cash payments of $10 and $15 a week. These people are low-income insureds, and the insurance company has thousands of them. That makes a great deal of money by making them rely on this handwritten and the later computer-generated receipts. They have to rely on their agents, and the company knows it because it set that system up. For it to deny that the policy was in effect after at least receiving those receipts, I can't think of any logical explanation.
But you must be making a claim of constructive knowledge. I mean, there's no reason to believe that the person who wrote that letter actually had checked the company's records and found that that the first policy had lapsed. Your theory is a rather elaborate one, that even that the disloyal agents somehow were misleading the company and caused the company, therefore, to give an accurate answer to her. Is that fraud?
Yes, Your Honor. That is exactly fraud in Illinois. Corporations only act through their employees.
These people aren't employees. They're agents, you say.
Through its employees and agents. They are agents, and under Illinois law, spotted superior, principal is liable for the fraud of its agent in the course of his conduct. That's never been disputed in this case. The issue raised by the trial court was reliance.
Well, wait. That's not accurate. The usual rule responding at superior is you're not liable for the intentional torts of your agent unless those intentional torts are somehow intended to serve the principal. So if an agent used improper methods of debt collection in order to help his principal would be liable. But if the agent is entirely on a frolic of his own, stealing, not trying to benefit the company in any way, but just acting on his own behalf, you don't have automatic vicarious liability.
But those aren't the facts in this case, because they were collecting premiums for American General. They were issuing receipts for American General. They were selling policies for American General. This is directly within their scope of employment. Whether or not they defrauded the company at the same time they're defrauding my client, they're still chargeable.
Well, no, that's important. If they're defrauding the company, it's a fraud against the company. They're not acting on the company's behalf. But let me ask you another question. What is the status of these premiums? Now, this, what, $37 or something, that excess premiums?
They have not been repaid. And most
of
them have
never
been
repaid. That's part of your suit. You want that plus the punitive damages, yes, attorney's fees, and all that. Okay, thank you, Mr. Novotny?
May it please the court. My name is David Novotny.
Before you begin, what is the status of these excess premiums? What were the legal status?
Your Honor, I don't believe it's ever really been determined if there is a differential and what the amount of the differential
was. Well, does
was.
This
was
mean
no
that even if we agreed with you about the unavailability of punitive damages and, you know, got over the hump of the amount in controversy, we'd have to send it back for a trial on whether you owe them $37? That would be too absurd for words.
No, Your Honor, if the case is turned by this court to be worth at a maximum $37, I suspect there would not be a trial.
What do you mean you suspect there would not be a trial?
Well, it
would. What would happen if we said that? You would pay $37, right?
I would certainly think the client would think seriously.
Okay.
I would like to respond briefly to the discovery issue, and I would point out that this is not of record. There aren't any documents that were produced in discovery that counsel referred to that made it into the record. I would just underscore that I could respond in terms of what the documents showed substantively and what was produced. Obviously, there were a great deal of documents produced. What happened actually was that there were requests made for certain categories of complaints. American General has files dealing with servicing customers who have inquiries. They categorize them differently than plaintiff's categorization in his production request. So the company tried as best it could to match its categories with the categories that plaintiff was talking about. And ultimately, a large volume was produced. But again, many of these were people asking, I have a question about this. I thought I paid this premium. You know, here's the entry in my receipt book, things of that nature.
Well, why do people take out life insurance policies on children? Seems an odd. Well, what's the theory of that?
I believe the theory is, I think one theory is that it would cover funeral expenses in the unfortunate event of the death of a child.
Usually you think of life insurance as replacing the income a loss by the death of the insured, and with children it seems odd because actually the expenses of the parents are lower after the children die, except for the funeral expense you point out. It seems odd.
I believe
let me ask you a question about the theory of fraud, if you will, that the district court relied on. District court seemed to say that because Mrs. Smith was seeking information about why her premiums had gone up, she was somehow chargeable with awareness that all of these allegedly fraudulent activities were going on, that she had half the policy benefit. They said, how could you have relied if you were asking questions? And that seems like a very big leap to me. One can ask questions based on, let's say, a surface of information and have no idea that below the surface of the water is the rest of the iceberg of the fraud that's going on. And it strikes me that the district court made some very extravagant assumptions about whether she could or could not have relied and whether the information American General was giving her was or was not material.
Well, I think we need to look at what the specific documents were that the fraud claim is based on. One of the documents was a copy of the application for the second policy that was shown.
Which she, of course, had never seen. The one with the forged signature and the wrong, it's not even her signature that they're relying on.
No, she saw the application for the policy.
This is the thing that the unnamed supervisor waves in front of her at one point and won't give her?
That was her testimony, yes. And then also...
But do we know from that testimony whether it allegedly had her signature or Isaac's signature or anybody else's signature? It could be a third document altogether.
It bore a sig... Well, there's only oral testimony about that particular occasion when the document was shown to the plaintiff.
And what did that oral testimony show about who had made the application?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that it showed that Isaac signed the policy and purportedly made the application because the signature stated Isaac Smith.
That's what we know from later on, but do we know that occasion is the same document as the application that's later found when everybody really starts looking into this?
I would have to say no, because there was no photocopy of the document as the document was given to the plaintiff on that occasion.
Right.
I suppose that's an open question.
Asked for it. And when was this application shown to her?
The application, according to her testimony, the application was shown to her at some point after the computerized receipts began to be used by the company.
I'm wondering if Isaac was above or below the age of 18 at that time.
In all honesty, Your Honor, I'm not sure. My recollection is that he was close. He might not have been 18.
Right, and if he was still a minor, he couldn't have done it for himself anyway.
I'm not sure what the company's internal guidelines were on that, in terms of whether they would accept an application from a minor. I suspect Your Honor has a good point.
It just seems to me that there is so little information in front of her that even though she's asking for an explanation about why she has to pay more, as your opponent points out, the answer might have been because paragraph such and such of your initial policy says that we can, within certain limits, raise the premiums. In which case, you know, and she really didn't want this insurance policy to lapse, so she takes the approach that she's just going to keep paying, keep you happy, and in the meantime, sort out the monetary issues. If she needs to ask you for a refund later, she can ask you for a refund later, but she doesn't want to stop paying, risk your saying, okay, the whole policy's over, and lose whatever benefit she was hoping to get from the policy. It's hard for me to see that she has enough knowledge that she wasn't, in fact, relying on a whole set of other facts, such as that she still had a $15,000 policy, and that she has had uninterrupted coverage for her son, stepson, whatever he was.
Well, I think we need to go back to what the plaintiff's theory is here and what the plaintiff's claim is. And with respect to that application, the claim is that the display of the application to her was a false statement of some kind. And that's really the first argument that we raise, is what is the statement that that is conveyed by displaying an application.
But it's pretty clear she doesn't understand that this means that there's been a two-year hiatus from the first policy to the second policy, and she now has a completely different policy that may or may not be the same. When she makes her application upon his death for benefits, she plainly thinks that it's the 1991 policy.
Well, actually, the application that was submitted for the, or the claim form for the death benefits identified the second policy.
Well, by number, but she knew that $7,500 wasn't what she had been paying for. That was her belief, anyway. You came back and said, oh, no, yes, it is $7,500. But she's expecting a $15,000 death benefit. That's what brought us to this position today, right?
Well, that's true. That's true.
Why would a policy with half the face amount carry higher premiums?
A policy with a lower face amount carry higher premiums. I suspect it was because he was older at the time of the application for the second policy.
Not much older. That's more than doubling the price of the policy. It's not as if he went from being 3 years old to 60.
Well, I certainly age would factor into it. I don't know what the company's underwriting guidelines are. That actually never came up in the case, but certainly I would think that age would have something to do with it.
Why didn't the company simply refund these excess premiums?
I would have to say, Your Honor, that first of all, I'm not sure that, I can't concede that there were excess premiums, and the reason I say that is because the first policy lapsed, and then there was a period of time before the second policy was reinstated.
Well, you say it lapsed, but you paid her eventually as if it hadn't lapsed.
And she was paying you all along. She had both the handwritten receipts and the computer receipts to show that her payment stream never stopped. And that, at least, your agents were authorized to do. You are certainly charged with their collection of those monies.
That's true. They're authorized to collect money.
Right.
There's
no question
about
that.
And
they did. She had proof that they had been.
Mm-hmm.
And sell policies.
That's correct. That's correct.
You're not disputing this was a forged application, are you?
Because
it sounds like you maybe you are.
Well, I would have to say that there's a lack of proof on that, but certainly when the company saw the signatures, we don't know what the company was thinking. If they just decided it's not worth spending any more time on this, we'll just pay the $7,500, I don't know. I certainly will concede that Isaac's signature, actually the name Isaac is misspelled apparently, or it's spelled differently on the application for the second policy than it was on some of the other exemplars. But
are
there
those
was
exemplars in the record? Is the application and the exemplars? Are the application
yes,
exemplars?
They are. Yes, those are in the record. But again, I would hasten to point out that is the company acted extremely promptly when it saw these signatures and saw
well, but
the
it
exemplars.
Still hasn't refunded the premium, the excess premiums.
If there is, again, all I can say is that I can't concede that there is a discrepancy. If there is a discrepancy, it was $38 and
I don't
likely got lost
you
in the shuffle.
You can't concede, you don't concede there's a discrepancy. What does that mean?
Well, we didn't sit down and figure that out for purposes of the motion, so it's really not argued or set forth in the motion. But if there is a $38 discrepancy, as the plaintiff contends, I think it's clear from the correspondence back and forth that it just got lost in the shuffle. The company did pay the additional $7,500 in death benefit and interest on top of that.
But the other thing, of course, is because the company had made all these mistakes early on, before Isaac's death, it did cost Mrs. Smith $2,500 in attorney's fees to get the money that she should have gotten just as a matter of course upon his death. That, I think, is the real, putting the punitives to one side, that's her real gripe here, that you made a mistake and she's paying for it, to put it very simply.
Your Honor, I would have to say that it's on the basis of this record, it's very unclear as to what happened or who made a mistake.
But it wasn't she. It was either your agents or you. It certainly wasn't Mrs. Smith, who was paying dutifully all along.
Well, we've never argued that it was a mistake on her
part.
Right,
so why did she have to pay the price, the $2,500 price of making you do the thing you should have done?
Well, again, I think we need to get back to what the theories are in this case, and there's no question there's a puzzle about what on earth went on here. The plaintiff testified that she asked for one of the policies to be lapsed. Somehow another one got lapsed instead, and then there's the second policy. It's a puzzle as to what happened, but the question is, does that amount to common law fraud? And again, I would emphasize that the complaint seeks recovery against American General solely on the basis of respondeat superior, solely on the basis of some alleged fraud that was committed by some persons out here.
Your agents were collecting money for payments for a two-year period of time when it was your position there was no policy in place. But the point is that action attributable to you when you have just now stood here and told me that, of course, yes, they were authorized to collect money?
Well, Your Honor, I would have to say that...
Has American General ever said that they never received those payments? Is there anything about that in the record?
There's nothing about that in the record, Judge. But again, I would emphasize that that's not the theory of the plaintiff's case. The theory of the plaintiff's case is that there were four instances where there were misrepresentations.
Well, she argues that the district court over-categorized those four instances. I think she has tried to get away from that. I know that's the way the district judges were looking at it. Is that correct?
And it's the way it was pleaded, and I'm really not sure how else you could look at it. If a plaintiff is contending that there were four instances when a fraudulent misrepresentation was made, I think you've got to look at each one and apply the elements of the cause of action.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Novotny.
Thank you.
Mr. McLean, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Very briefly, Your Honor. As to the imputing the conduct of the agents for both common law and consumer fraud, I'd like to point out to the court that consumer fraud in Illinois, there is no scienter necessary. There is no intent. We don't need to impute the intent of the agents to the insurance company. It's just the false statements. And the false receipts, both handwritten and computerized, were clearly statements made on behalf of the company. Second, whether the agents were involved in fraud against the insurer or not, the insurer clearly has ratified that conduct, both by defending, even to today, everything the agents did, defending even to fraud, forged applications, and retaining the benefit.
Why did you stipulate that you didn't have a case on the one part of the theory that the district judge thought you did?
Your Honor, I could not think of a way to present to a jury an argument that my client paid $11.59 beginning in January of 1996 without referencing the receipt. The judge had said, as a matter of fact, she did not pay, and my time is expired.
No,
to make
finish your sentence.
The judge ruled that she had not, as a matter of law, in fact relied on those computerized receipts and paying the additional amount. I didn't see any way to proceed, even on the underlying claim of fraud for the $2,500 in attorney fees and $36 in premium, without referencing the fact that she paid that amount solely because American General told her that she owed it through those computerized receipts.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McLean. Thank you to both counsel. Next case for our